So that's my title, Crisis and Opportunity, or if you like, Crisis and the Extent to Which We May Retain Confidence in Science. It's about data. Why data? Because almost all scientists use it. And if we don't get the data right, then the science doesn't go right either. My view is that the data problem is now such a big one. It's creating a crisis of confidence in the results of science. And unless we can correct that crisis of confidence, then the opportunity that data is there to deliver for us simply will not be delivered. But first of all, a little history. This is Henry Oldenburg. Henry was a German theologian who was the first secretary of the newly created Royal Society in London in the early 1660s. Henry was a very keen correspondent. He corresponded with people that we now call scientists from all over the world. And he persuaded the new society that it would be a good idea that rather than keep his correspondence private, the society should publish it. And this is the title page of the first edition of the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society, which effectively was Henry's correspondence. And it's still a frontline journal, of course. But Henry had two requirements of his correspondence. The first one was that they should write in the vernacular and not in Latin. Doesn't seem a big thing now, but it wasn't the time. And secondly, and absolutely crucially, if they presented a concept, that concept must be associated with the evidence, that is to say, the data, on which the concept was based. It permitted others to scrutinize the logic of the relationship between evidence and concept. It permitted others to attempt to replicate either the observation or the experiment. And it's been argued by historians of science that it's been the bedrock on which scientific progress in the last three centuries has been based. And arguably, if there is such a thing as a scientific method, this is it. This is a rather lovely quotation from Arthur Koestler that I think rather beautifully describes what's been called scientific self-correction, and that is the capacity to demonstrate error. And as implied here, errors have been numerous, and the desert trail is strewn with these rather strange theories in the past, though they didn't seem very strange at the time. But the world of Arthur Koestler and of Henry Oldenburg has changed dramatically, and it's changed because of this veritable storm of data that we've seen developing in the last few years. We now have quite unprecedented volumes of data through digital means of acquisition, which are increasingly inexpensive and powerful, through our means, ways by which we may store data, we may analyze it and instantaneously transmit it. I was going to show this slide, but as our chairman has spoilt my line, I won't. It shows the dramatic decrease in the cost of genome sequencing. And indeed now, almost any device that has a power source is able to collect non-trivial information from the environment within which it's contained. But a problem has developed. Well, we don't know whether it's developed recently, but it's certainly there to be seen. And it's illustrated here. This is a paper published in Nature 3 years ago in the domain of preclinical oncology, in which an American group looked at the top 50 benchmark papers in the previous decade and attempted to replicate the results. They were only able to do so in 11% of cases. Quite extraordinary. Since then, a number of similar replication efforts have found similar consequences. Here's one from about 2 months ago in the area of social psychology. Last week, there was a major report on research and economics, all of them showing similar phenomenon. That's to say that the majority of the results simply could not be replicated and reproduced. This evidence now has been filtering out beyond the doors of the scientific laboratory. This is the Economist magazine of 3 years ago. Scientists like to think of science as self-correcting. To an alarming degree, it is not. It has the potential really to undermine the confidence in science, and indeed to undermine the opportunities that lie before us. So what's the issue? It's quite simple. We can't reproduce the results of many papers. Why? Well, the analysis so far is that a significant number, possibly decreasing, have been because of fraudulent invention of data, which is a crime. invalid reasoning, which is not a crime, but it's something we should try to avoid. And thirdly, either absence of data or inadequate reproduction of data, or the metadata, which is the data about data that permits you to use the data and scrutinize it. All of those things have the potential to go wrong. I want to concentrate on two things. First of all, the production of data and metadata, and secondly, invalid reasoning, and talk a little bit about fraudulent behavior, or possibly talk about it. Why is this happening? Or why might it be increasing? It might be increasing because there's strong pressure to publish. It may be because that we have pressure to make excessive claims for the work that we do. And it may also be, I believe it is the case, that we have rather poor data science in many cases. What's the partial solution? The partial solution is open data. And this is what a report from the Royal Society of about 4 years ago claims the right way to treat data. That data had to be not just data that was dumped in a repository, but it had to be what we called intelligently open data. That's to say, you have to have the capacity to find it, the capacity to import it onto the machine in which you can replicate the analysis. You've got to be able to understand it, it's got to be intelligible, you've got to be able to assess it. You know, what was the competence of the people who did this job? And last and probably most important of all, it's got to be reusable. And increasingly, not only the data and the metadata are required, but also the software used in any computer manipulation. And only when those criteria are satisfied is the data properly open. What sort of data are we collecting these days? And the answer is enormous volumes, enormous quantities of great diversity. This is just one example, which illustrates two things. First of all, these are a series of satellites which collect information about the Earth's cloud cover. They collect information about different aspects of that cloud cover, and as it happens, they're each one of them here looking at ozone levels in the atmosphere. The amount of data being generated is enormous. The velocity with which it's streaming into the machines that try to collect this data and out of the machines into analytical devices is extraordinary. That's so-called big data. But secondly, and crucially, it's a whole series of devices which are independently attempting to observe aspects of the same phenomenon. And we might call that broad data. We're looking at the same phenomenon, but from different perspectives. One of the things that, I'm rushing ahead, there are a number of things that this sort of data acquisition permits us to do. First of all, now we can see in many phenomena details of patterns which before were below our capacity to resolve, below our intellectual horizon, if you like. Secondly, they permit us to see correlations that we haven't understood before or observed before. And thirdly, and crucially, they permit us to reconstruct complexity in phenomena in ways that hitherto have not been possible. For 40 years now, we've been simulating complexity through computer models. Now, not only can we simulate it, but we can actually describe it. And if we iterate between the simulation and the description, then we have extraordinarily powerful means of exploring complex phenomena. And the most obvious one that you see daily is the modern weather forecast, which through this sort of iterative technique has produced forecasts of a precision which are really quite extraordinary. But there's one rather important thing that can be done, is increasingly being done with all this flood of broad data in particular, and it's represented here. This is a large number of databases that refer to the fertility of rice plantations. It doesn't actually matter what it's about, but they are a series of databases. And by creating a very simple statement about the relationship between each database and every other database, and that relationship doesn't have to be a numerical relationship, although it can be, then one can deduce patterns in this data which are about the whole assemblage of data. It's been exemplified in what's been called the semantic web. We're all of us familiar, of course, with the web of documents. When I interrogate Google, Google presents me with documents. A semantic web is one where the individual component databases have relationships with each other, and what I get by interrogating them is meaning. It's a very, very powerful way of doing things, and now there are in excess of 4 million databases globally that have been annotated in ways that permit you to do these sorts of things. Our view, very simply, is that when we publish papers, we must ensure that the data that we that relates to the argument in the paper is intelligently open. The pages of Nature aren't big enough to collect, to contain all this data and the necessary metadata required, so it needs to be concurrently made available with the publication of the paper, and our view is that to do otherwise should be regarded as scientific malpractice, and it's something we have to stop. But the other dimension I just want very briefly to talk about is the way we reason from these vast and complex data volumes. At the top left here, I've put on a very simple linear regression where we have a dependent and independent variable, we have a nice regression line, we can express a relationship quite readily. At the bottom left, you see a series of clusters, and we have good classical statistical methods for recognizing clusters and determining how heavily clustered they are. But if we have data which produces a pattern similar to the one you see on the top right, which is something that looks like an ostrich, then you could put a regression line through that if you like, but it would be totally meaningless. And unfortunately, what's happening with these large and complex data volumes, we're applying statistical techniques increasingly that do not permit you to reason validly from the data which we have. Typically now, we have to think in terms of topological techniques represented by the bottom right here. We need to do things rather differently. So what's the general outcome of what I've been arguing? I've been arguing that essentially we have a serious issue of credibility in the presentation of modern science. If we permit that issue of credibility to persist into this domain of big, broad, semantically linked data, which is extremely difficult for us cognitively to grasp, machines have to do it for us, what we're doing is embedding in the machine error that we can't pull out. In other words, we're creating a science, we have the potential to create a science which will not only be meaningless, but thoroughly misleading, and what's more, one of the things that we risk is essentially the privatization of knowledge rather than open knowledge of the sort that I'm sure most of we scientists wish to be realized. Thank you.